This week on Making Contact.
One of the core messages of Soul, which I think I explored at first, is it doesn't have to be grim work.
Seattle author Paul Loeb is re-releasing his book, Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times. He's collected stories of everyday people working for social justice.
Say yes. Choose yes and do something positive, even though it's frustrating.
For his book, Loeb chose a diverse group to share their personal journeys and reflect on what they're fighting for and why.
You know, I thought me not having no shoes was a big problem until I saw the man that didn't have no feet.
On this edition, we hear from Paul Loeb and two ordinary people turned activists profiled in his book. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Author Paul Loeb has been writing books about activism and apathy since the 1980s. On book tours, people would often ask him how they too could get involved and take a stand for social justice in the face of seemingly insurmountable obstacles. The book, Soul of a Citizen, was Loeb's response. When he set out to write Soul of a Citizen, Loeb interviewed dozens of Americans, people who, for one reason or another, began to recognize an inherent problem in their own lives or in their communities. They weren't activists or politicians, but each one of them decided that community involvement was the key to creating change.
I wrote Soul of a Citizen. It came out in 1999, which is just eons ago. And people still are responding to it. I mean, people who are discovering it fresh are saying, oh, this is a wonderful book. It's really inspiring and all that. But I felt like a lot had changed. I mean, this was before George Bush. This was before Iraq, or at least Iraq II. This was before Obama. This was, I mean, much. Well, in some ways different and in some ways a cautionary tale, because I was writing it at the end of the Clinton years, where people were essentially becoming very demoralized, very disengaged. And there was a very direct correlation, I think, between that and what gave us George Bush. And so there was a sense of possibility, which was different from certainly that Clinton period, late Clinton period. And was certainly different from Bush, where you're just thinking what god-awful horror is going to come down the pike next week, next day, next month. And so it just felt like it was time to revisit it. And I sort of thought, oh, well, I'll just do this and it's not going to be a huge deal. And then maybe because that's the way I work, I started looking at every sentence, every line, every paragraph and saying, does it ring true to today? And of course, it's a little complicated because today keeps shifting as to what it happens to feel like. But I really wanted it to ring true to this period and not just to a period a dozen years ago, and to give people what they needed to act now.
Allison Smith of Portland, Maine, decided to take action. She co-chairs Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, a group that worked to pass campaign finance reform back in the mid-90s. Now they act as a watchdog for the Maine Clean Election Act, the nation's first law giving candidates the option to use public funding and grassroots donations instead of private and personal funding for their campaign. But Smith wasn't always involved in campaign finance reform. Her journey began in Connecticut, standing up for land use laws and wetland regulations in her town.
Well, truthfully, it's very embarrassing to think back to that because I just was so completely green, you know, didn't know really anything about anything. But, you know, we lived in this kind of rural town in Connecticut, which we picked because it was famous for having lots of open space. So one weekend, it was Thanksgiving weekend one year, and these bulldozers came in and basically drained a swamp next to our house and, you know, prepared the ground for putting in culverts and things. And the next thing we knew, there were house lots there. And I mean, this was a swamp. This was looked like a protected wetland. And turned out it was an old subdivision that those lots had never been built on because they were too wet. So it was never, you know, plausible to build on them. But now, with the sort of greed of the 1980s, some developer wanted to build houses on them, never mind how wet they were. So, you know, lots of things happened. I really didn't even know who to talk to about something like that. But I went to a town meeting because I was interested and I was curious about, you know, what had happened next door to my house. And I guess at this point I had talked to people in town, so I sort of kind of knew what had gone on. But I still didn't understand why it happened and why these homes were allowed to be built on wetland when our town, you know, had these great wetland regulations that disallowed building on wetlands and draining wetlands and filling wetlands and so forth. So I found myself at this town meeting where, you know, people were talking about these different land use issues. And I don't know what moved me. I think I was so frustrated by hearing, you know, all this sort of happy talk about things. And I just found myself like raising my hand and getting up and talking about what went on next to my house and how it seemed inconsistent, to say the least, with the town, what the town says they want and so forth. Truthfully, what I mostly remember about that is just how deeply embarrassing it was. It was almost like an out-of-body experience. But what happened after that is that after the meeting, a lot of people came up to me in the hallway after the meeting broke up and said, I've been thinking the same thing for years and I just never had the nerve to stand up and say it, or I'm really glad you said that I've been thinking the same thing and it needed to be said. And one of my neighbors came up to me and she said, you really ought to join the League of Women Voters. And I said, you know, what? You know, what's that? And I'm not really much of a joiner. And it was pivotal for me because she dragged me. She worked on me, you know, over the next few months and did get me to come to a League of Women Voters meeting in my local town. And, you know, I really had no idea till then about how towns work, you know, how did things move and shake in a town? Well, there were all these, you know, civic-minded people who stood up and, you know, got involved and made the town what it was. And I really just was quite clueless up until then. And so I got sort of a civic education through the League of Women Voters and found a whole cadre of people who not only cared about things like open space preservation and wetlands preservation, but actually had worked over the years to create these land use laws and, you know, make the town the nice place it was to live.
After moving to Maine, Smith stayed involved with the League of Women Voters. She found herself caught up in a high-profile campaign to pass the Maine Clean Elections Act. The group found out throughout the state, and in one day, more than 1,000 volunteers, including Smith, collected enough signatures to get the issue on the ballot. The Clean Elections Bill passed with 56% of the vote, and by 2008, it became the preferred system for the majority of candidates in the state. Maine's two Republican senators chose to support similar reforms in Congress, and other states have also begun to follow suit with their efforts for public financing. Smith says she didn't set out to become a leader in the movement for clean elections. Instead, she gives all the credit to those who believed in her.
What it took for me, truly, was a lot of other people who had a lot more faith in me than I did to kind of see an open door and push me through it. At most of the steps of the way, I've been a fairly reluctant person to come forward and step into areas way beyond my comfort zone. I guess we all have that a little bit in us, except for the most outgoing among us who just sort of exude confidence. But, you know, personally, I, you know, find it difficult to believe that I can do something before I've actually done it. And I'm, you know, when I see what we've done here in Maine and how these sort of leaps of faith have really made a difference over the years, it's, you know, it's pretty powerful. We wouldn't have a Maine Clean Election Act if it weren't for regular citizens who took it upon themselves to lead.
Smith says it's easy to get discouraged in her line of work, but the key is to remain optimistic despite one's own doubts.
If I had taken that path of cynicism and thought, oh, there's no hope, you know, why get involved because everybody knows money corrupts and so you're never going to have politics without money, you know, that would have been a simpler path, for sure. But What does that really say about us? I mean, if we're not willing to tackle these issues in our time, you know, what good are we? I mean, what are we leaving? You know, you look at these individual issues, like look what we've done to the planet. You know, look what we've done to our economic system. Look what we've done to our healthcare. Can't even really call it a system, but look at the inequities in healthcare across our country and the crazy things we spend money on and the outcomes that we have. And, you know, we have to solve these problems. These are the challenges of our time, and we need to be up to the challenge. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I work in the area of campaign finance reform, and if ever there was an area that deserved skepticism, if not cynicism, it's it. The role that money plays in politics and how it affects our ability to govern ourselves is just a profoundly troubling area, as we have seen in, you know, recent Supreme Court decisions and so forth. It just gets to, you know, really the fundamental question, is democracy ever going to work? I mean, we've been at this for a little more than 200 years, and I think, you know, we hope that we'll be around for a few hundred more, but these are profoundly troubling questions. So I think for me, you know, I had done some work in the area of healthcare reform and environmental issues. And, you know, as an activist, as a concerned citizen, there are certain things you can do. You can write a letter to the editor, you can go to a hearing, you can call your legislator and tell them what you think about a particular bill. And I just feel like it's a lot more fun to be doing that stuff than it is to be, you know, slinging bat shots at a bar and complaining about the state of the world and how we're all going to die because of climate change or whatever. You know what I mean? It just seems like, you know, say yes. Choose yes and do something positive. Try to be part of the solution, even though it's frustrating.
Despite the challenges of activism, one of the reoccurring themes in Soul of a Citizen is that social involvement can and should be enjoyable. Paul Loeb.
One of the core messages of Soul, which I think I explored at first in the original edition, but really have amplified now, is it doesn't have to be grim work. I remember a student saying, he was agonizing about driving 70 miles to go hear Ani DeFranco, who was one of his favorite musicians. And I'm like, because he was working on global climate change and he was going to have to use gas. And it's like, go. Yeah, carpool. Do it efficiently, but go see her, because Ani DeFranco is going to charge you up and give you energy. And that's what you need. And if you feel like, you know, you're going to just be beating yourself up for not addressing all the problems of the world or for living a contradictory life in a complex world, well, that's that perfect standard again, where we just beat yourself up unless everything lines up impossibly. So you got to enjoy it.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Soul of a Citizen. Paul Loeb is re-releasing the new and revised edition of his book, Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times, in April 2010. It's an old adage, before you help others, you have to help yourself. Many of those featured in Soul of a Citizen had personal challenges to overcome before they could begin to address societal problems. David Lewis runs a drug rehab program and teaches cognitive behavioral therapy to those working in the social services. It's a stark contrast from his life growing up in East Palo Alto, California. Discouraged and disillusioned with school, Lewis started getting into trouble and abusing drugs and alcohol at a young age. Over the years, he spent 17 years incarcerated at California's San Quentin State Prison, the state's oldest prison and the only one with a death row.
I always describe it like this. I left home when I was about 15 years old, and like a lot of young people, start running the streets of East Palo Alto. And as a result of poor management and some bad decisions on my part, I became a consumer of the services that they provide in San Quentin for about 17 years. I grew up there. I grew up in prison. I didn't think I would ever get out, even though the charges that I was sent to prison for were very, very minor. I was arrested, took to trial, convicted, and sentenced from 10 years of life for selling an undercover narcotic agent $20 worth of heroin. And I need to say I wasn't a drug dealer or anything. I was a drug user. And the situation just happened like that, and I got caught up in that web. It was a time that in our country where the war on drugs and get tough on crime and all of that kind of stuff. And I was this little young black kid that was uneducated that got caught up in that system like that.
Lewis's turning point was the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. He recalls the details of that day and why, of all things, an earthquake convinced him to change his destructive lifestyle.
It was October 17th, 1989, probably about 5:02. Remember like it was my birthday or something. The building was shaking severely. I'm talking about really severely. Now, one of the things in being in prison, because it can be very violent, and your training is never allow yourself to be on the ground. You know, you always wanted to maintain your footing and stay on your feet. Because if you didn't, that's when you could get killed. If somebody got you on the ground or you fell on, you could get killed. And in my career, that was the first time that I was on the ground from this earthquake. And I got up and it shook and threw me down again. I was like, oh my God. So that being a significant situation for me and me not knowing how to control it, we didn't know what had happened. The emotions that went through me at that time was one of very vulnerable and very like, oh my God, what has happened? And have I lived up to this precious thing called life? Because all of a sudden it became very, very precious. And I can remember, you know, you grow up, and even if you don't acknowledge it, there's always something that you respond to, that you call on. And, you know, in my life now, I call it a higher power. And I remember saying, wow, what's the deal here? You know? Okay, if you were trying to get my attention, you got it, you know? I don't want to ever have to feel like this again. Then the whole concept of being irresponsible, because you know with a lot of major disasters, if something happens right now, you got your phone right now and you can call and find out if people are all right. And it's like you couldn't do that. You didn't know. Or they couldn't call you to see or tell you they wasn't all right. And that was a big, big, big deal for me. I had children. And I didn't know where or how they were surviving this thing, a mother, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And that made me feel so, so insignificant to the world that I said, OK, you got my attention and I need to know how to ever not put myself in this situation again. And that's that was October 17th. I think I got out in December. And that's when I went to a rehab and did something different from what my idea was that if I got out.
When Lewis got out of jail, he went to rehab and got sober. Wanting to share his experience of recovery with others like him, he started Free at Last, a rehab program, or as he calls it, a movement.
That's when I decided that I needed to get some help for myself. You know, one of the things that I always tell people in prison, you can walk in a prison right now and you can ask some of the most notorious people in there, say, well, if you got a chance to get out right now, what would you do? And they would say that, oh, I would go and open up of this and help children and do all this kind of stuff. But based on my experience, it's like, okay, first I need to help me. I need to get me together before I can help anybody else. Some of the things that the behaviors that we learn in prison, they don't work on the streets. You know, you can't settle arguments by breaking somebody's jaw, you know, and that's the method. That's the, you know, the integrity, the warped sense of integrity that you learn in prison. A lot of it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work out here. So first of all, it was to be able to change my own life. And then in changing my own life, what I realized, it was some other people that could possibly benefit from me changing my life. And that's when I started the process of creating this movement. I don't call our program a program. I call it a movement. It's the Free at Last Movement, because the thing that we do there that is kind of different from a lot of other people, a lot of other places like that, we don't have a lot of barriers. It's like, okay, what you bring to the party, we deal with it. We don't refer you out because you're mentally ill. We don't refer you out because you got AIDS. We don't refer you out because you're violent. It's like, yeah, we're dealing with all of that stuff in one pot. So it's a movement. It's a movement that's starting to catch on, not only in this country, but around the world, because that's who we see now, you know, is that person.
It wasn't a 9-to-5 operation. And of course, it didn't all take place in an office. David Lewis and his staff hit the streets, talked to people, encouraged them in a language they could understand to change their lives. In addition to his wildly successful efforts here in the States, Lewis also made numerous trips to Africa. In Kenya, he set up similar programs using the same methods and ideals as Free at Last.
Sometimes you have to go back to some of the elders' concepts and theories and stuff that they would say that you didn't think made no sense of at all. And I found a lot of that stuff later on in my life to be so true. And we give you an example. I was in a place in Nairobi teaching a mental health hospital a few years ago. And this guy walked up to me after I got finished and he told me, he said, you know, I really enjoyed your presentation. I could relate to so much of it. He said, now, the thing that he said, I understand, you know, having hope and rehabilitation and fighting and being able to change. He said, when I was a kid living here in Nairobi, he said, my family was so poor. He said he was about 8 years old. He said it was so poor that the missionaries used to come in and teach them about reincarnation when you die. And he said that he used to pray to God every night that he would die and come back as a dog in America. Yeah. And I was like, whoa, that's deep. So one of the things that happens that after he told me that, I had to ask myself the question in my education, was I really going down the right trail? Because see, here in the United States or in a lot of other countries, we can give people hope by dangling a carrot, a house, a car, or some new clothes, and you know, all of that stuff, right? But in places like that, it's like the hope that you give people is to be able to right themselves with their creator, to be better family people and all that kind of stuff. I don't care how much they change their life, they're gonna still live in the same mud hut. They're not gonna ever have a car. They're going to still wait by the dock until the boat comes in with the hand-me-down clothes from America and Europe. That's all that's going to happen. That makes sense to you? So in looking at that and looking at that whole concept, I would advise people in these trying times that we live in now, right here in America, they're trying, but they're nothing compared to other people in the world. I heard Deepak Chopra say this a couple days ago. He said, what we do in our society, especially in this country, we spend money that we haven't earned yet. to buy things that we don't need, to impress people that we don't even like, you know. And it's like, wow, that's us. Black, white, red, yellow, the American society, Western society seems to produce that, and it's starting to produce it from the time that, you know, we're kids, as that's who we are. So I would tell people to take on that elders, you know, the elders used to say, I thought me not having no shoes was a big problem until I saw the man that didn't have no feet. And I think people will take a different perspective.
The stories of David Lewis and Allison Smith are inspiring because they are living proof of a fact that we all know to be true. Creating positive change can come from anyone, anywhere, and at any time. Paul Loeb's Soul of a Citizen recognizes this potential in everyday people to become advocates for social change.
For movements to succeed, they need two parallel elements. They need people to take those leap of faith, for lack of a better word, the notion that their actions can matter, to overcome what I call learned helplessness, the idea that there's nothing that we do is going to make any difference, and it's just pounded into us. And you say, well, we don't know. We're not sure, but certainly there's evidence in history that our actions can matter, and there's evidence in recent history, so let's take that leap of faith. So they need those psychological, spiritual, what, call them whatever you will. They need those elements. But they also need to participate in something that amplifies our individual voices and creates common power. And so if I go back to the Rosa Parks story, had she been a lone activist on the bus, in absent any kind of movement, her action would simply have passed unnoticed. And so to me, in any time, yes, the spontaneous actions are very important, but you also need organizational vehicles to be able to amplify those individual voices, because frankly, you know, we're certainly up against such huge institutions of power that it takes sometimes millions of people acting to be able to overcome them.
At some point in our society here, it's like, how do we acknowledge the soul of a citizen and let that soul flourish and quit asking that soul to justify their soul? To be able to teach people that it's all right to acknowledge what's in your soul. And here's methods and ways to be able to express that in a way that not only that other people can acknowledge that that's what your soul is, but it actually can get up and walk and start to implementing different strategies and different processes, that kind of thing. I think we have to do more and more and more of that.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts of interviews with people featured in Paul Loeb's new revised edition of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times. It's available April 2010. Special thanks to intern Elena Daigle for producing this show as part of Making Contact's internship program. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our programming for free to radio stations across the U.S. and in Canada and South Africa. Thank you, and thanks for listening to Making Contact.